to the Outlook Blog. I am your host, Frank Nguyen. It's my pleasure to be with you today to share the third installment of a three-part series on the proper pronunciation of God's name, as well as the realization that God gave but one name to Moshe when he introduced himself and was quite clear that forevermore, he only wants to be known by the name Yahweh. So we're going to recommence recognizing that it's always helpful when we begin a segment of a program that we gain our bearings. And in this case, you'll understand that Moshe grew up in the royal family of Pharaoh. The Pharaoh was most likely Thutmose III or Thutmose the Great, as he was known. And he, as a member of the royal household, would have been a highly privileged individual, although he would have likely been in the Egyptian military as well, and deeply involved in both the Egyptian religion, where Pharaoh was perceived as a god, and also in the overall life of Egypt with its overwhelming government and economic system that was based on what we would call a caste system. So that you are aware, for those who haven't studied the Torah, one day as Moshe was witnessing what the Egyptian taskmasters were doing to the hundreds of thousands of Hebrew slaves, beating them to the point of death, after the Pharaoh had already started annihilating them by killing the firstborn men, boys, babies, if you will, who would have grown into being productive men. And he intervened to save the life of the Hebrew. And in so doing, the perpetrator died. When Moshe then was confronted by the Hebrews that he had spared, whose lives he had saved, rather than be appreciative and thank him for risking his life to save theirs, they criticized him. They demeaned him. They were irascible, cantankerous, and just generally awful. A tendency that would linger with them throughout the Exodus and even into this day. Moshe left Egypt, which was indicative of the fact that if we are desirous of being part of Yahweh's covenant family, his Bereh, the first requirement, the only prerequisite, is to walk away from country, from religious and political influences. And in this regard, Moshe left the politics and the religiosity of Egypt behind. He moved to the western Arabian desert, was in the land of Midian. And first we see him, he's showing his character once again. Some young women were tending sheep and they were attacked by a band of hoodlums. And Moshe once again did the right thing. He intervened and stood between the would-be bandits and the women, protecting them. It is a character indication of Moshe that would follow him throughout the next 80 years of his life. When Moshe was 80 years old, Yahweh met with him at the base of Mount Horeb. We read about that introduction in our first two programs on Yahweh's name. There, Yahweh called out to Moshe by name, and he introduced himself to the man who would serve as little leader. As we have progressed in this analysis, one of the things that we learn is that Yahweh appeared to Moshe not as the entirety of God, because the entirety of God won't fit into Arabia, much less into any place on our planet, much less our solar system, even the galaxy in which our solar system resides. God is a seven-dimensional being, and we live in a three-dimensional universe. Actually, our universe is probably six dimensions, but three of them that we are familiar with, and God won't fit into that constraint, a situation. So God appeared to Moshe as a melech, which is a spiritual messenger or spiritual implement, through whom he was able to speak and through whom he was able to show an aspect of his nature, which was fire. And we learn that it was not a burning bush. There was no shrubs damaged in the process, that the flame emerged from the rocky crag that was on the top of Mount Chor. So we're going to pick up the narrative at this point, and it begins in the Torah in a book called Shemot, which means names. It has been corrupted to Exodus 3:11. And it has been corrupted to Exodus based upon a transliteration of a Greek term, when in fact the entire Torah was revealed in Hebrew. And the very fact that we're searching for the name of God as it is revealed in the Torah, wouldn't you naturally expect that the presentation of how we came to know Yahweh's name is in a book named Names, Shem in the plural, is Shemoth. But Moshe said to the Almighty, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and actually bring out the children of Israel from the crucibles of oppression?" Mitzrayim is the term for Egypt, if you will. Egypt happens to also be a Greek term. So much of what God said to his people in Hebrew has been filtered through the Greek language because of the enormous influence Christianity, which was scribed in Greek initially by Paul and then by others that were part of his company, to corrupt this message, that many of the terms now that we read are Egyptian in Bible translations as opposed to the original Hebrew. In Hebrew, Mitzrayim is important. It is a compound word, as we learned not too long ago in our previous program, where the my or ma interrogative in Hebrew precedes shore. And my or ma encourage us to ponder the implications of something. And shar in this case would mean something that is deeply troubling, something that is confining, anguishing. It speaks of severe persecution and oppression, as if in a crucible. And the only things that are capable of oppressing and persecuting a wide range of people, the masses, if you will, in this case, 600,000 Hebrews, are religion and politics. And so Mitzrayim is the crucibles of oppression perpetrated by religion and politics. So having lived and subsequently left Mitzrayim, Moshe was not only the only qualified and available person to perform this mission, because he had come to know the religion of the Mitzrah, and he came to know the government of the Pharaoh. And he saw the caste system that diminished the value of lives and controlled people's every move. And he was disgusted by them. He disavowed religion and politics and government and the culture that he grew up in, even though he had been an elitist in it. And he walked away, which is exceedingly important for us, because as the Torah teaches us in Bereshit, its first book, the first thing that Abraham had to do before he and Sarah were even considered for the Bereth covenant relationship was to walk away from, in their case, Babylon. Babel means to confuse by intermixing and to confound by commingling truth with lies. You see, that's how the religious and the political confound the masses. Rather than spewing outright lies, they will weave enough truth into their message to make the lies appear credible, such as the basis of Judaism Christianity and Islam. So yes, Moshe at this time was a really old fellow. By his own admission, he had a speech impediment, which is perfect because that annuls a myth that is pervasive pertaining to Yahweh's name, and that Jews, religious Jews, and then religious Christians would tell you that the reason that they do not pronounce Yahweh's name is because of their great respect for it, and they don't want to offend God by mispronouncing it. So God's argument to that issue was written many thousands of years before they contrived it. And God's answer was, if I choose a man who has a speech impediment to introduce my name to my people, then you can be assured that I'm not going to be offended by you mispronouncing it. If you want to offend me, erase it. Which is what Judaism and Christianity and then Islam have done. Now, Moshe was an alleged murderer. It meant that he had a death sentence hanging over his head. But none of that mattered, not to God. God does not work alone, and his criterion for choosing people are considerably different than ours. And this is an essential part of the message that we considered in our last program. That God could have gone in massive force by himself into Mitzrayim, which is just the plural of Mitzra, and he could have liberated his people. He could have foreclosed on not only this Pharaoh's dynasty, but on every Pharaoh. He could have leveled Egypt, eliminated the nation, and freed his people. He could have teleported them into the promised land. That isn't the way he works. God wants us to learn from him. He wants us to choose him. And in all cases, he wants to work together. That's the purpose of the covenant family. To enjoy the things of life together. And so Yahweh wants to, in all cases, work through us. And if the implement is flawed, as was the case with Moshe, so much the better. Because the magnificence of God's capability shines through our imperfections. By himself, or even with the entire Midian army, Moshe recognized that he was wholly inadequate. And this accurate self-assessment, along with his appreciation for the plight of his people, and he knew it better than anyone, made him an ideal implement. And he had the character to do what needed to be done, as he had demonstrated previously. He was willing to invest and to risk his own life to protect the oppressed. Now, in Moshe's case, he wasn't just the best choice. There simply were no other options. God told us as much when he explained why Moshe had left Mitzrayim. We can learn from him, but we ought not argue with God's rationale when he makes a choice in this regard. So after working with some 40 receptive Yisraelites since that time, each of whom God inspired his prophets, this is the first time that Yahweh has chosen a boy, one who appears far less qualified even to share his insights than was Moshe. Obviously, there were thousands of scholars, theologians, better educated and equipped to perform this mission since it began with creating an accurate and amplified translation of Yahweh's message as it was memorialized in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Somebody certainly should have been better educated and equipped to do this, calling his people out of Babylon by more accurately and completely presenting his prophetic testimony to his people. But the very fact is that God chooses character He chooses attitude. He chooses aptitudes and proclivities that he thinks are useful. And he works with people who are willing to listen to him and go where his words lead, which is something I have done for these past 23 years. By definition, those who are unwilling to listen to God, who won't even say his name, who prefer to be religious as opposed to embrace the relationship he ought to attend, are part of the plague. And so they cannot be part of the cure. For a scholar to maintain a standing in academia, they must ultimately profess what God detests: a politically correct, inclusive, multicultural, and exceedingly liberal agenda. They cannot serve as liberators because Yahweh's words lead in the opposite direction. Simply stated, theologians and scholars cannot do as God requests without undermining their careers and their standing in their religious and academic communities. So there has never been a cleric, academic professor, rabbi, priest, pastor, who has actually spoken for Yahweh. Third, there is a tendency for the acclaimed and credentialed to remain self-reliant and entrenched. For example, someone who enjoys what I have shared with them and has been enriched by it conveys part of my message to someone who makes a living by writing books. They will almost always be rebuffed, because such people get very much set in their ways and do not much like it when they're told that their gravy train is leading people in the wrong direction. The academics are far less likely to rely upon God. Yahweh works with us by empowering those who are open and receptive. With the distortions promoted by progressives today throughout politics, academia, and in the media, with rampant and grotesque anti-Semitism, cancel culture, critical race theory, Black Lives Matter, multiculturalism, feminism, non-binary genders, misandry, demographic or democratic socialism, as they call it, LGBTQIA plus, SWERFs, TERFs. I long for the time when the relative stupidity of political correctness was the extent of our issues, and now it is far worse. Slightly ahead of his time in 1984, Orwell wrote, "Every record has been destroyed or falsified. Every book rewritten. Every picture has been repainted. Every statue and street building has been renamed. Every date has been altered. And that process is continuing day by day, minute by minute. History has stopped. Nothing exists except an endless present in which the party is always right." Sounds like the New York Times, the Washington Post, the mainstream media, the United Nations. And it is the willingness to bow to revisionist mandates of the politicized left, along with the madness of the religious right, that has narrowed the field such that Yahweh was left with a lone, flawed, albeit serviceable, boy. Well, I have long assumed that I was offered this job per deflatum, the fact that no one else wanted it. Having studied Yahweh's preferences, it's also likely that I possessed many attributes that Yahweh wanted to develop. In addition, I had met his prerequisite, because like Moshe, I had experienced and rejected religion and politics by the time we were introduced. Such inquiry and introspection, even curiosity, are components of our interaction and communication with God. We should question everything and strive to appreciate why the narratives which comprise the Torah and prophets have been provided, why these details have been included, how they help shape our understanding of who God is, what He is offering, and what He expects in return. Our goal ought to be to understand the insights and the lessons which can be deduced from every discussion, and then ascertain how those lessons apply to us, not only as individuals, but as a culture and community today. Considering the speaker, this assurance from God should have been sufficient. So then he, this is God speaking, responded, "Indeed, I will be with you." That ought to have been enough. It certainly was for me 23 years ago. I cannot help, though, but laugh, even in the most telling of passages, Yahweh has inserted something I find hilarious, especially in light of my own personal inadequacies. While the primary meaning of M, as it was rendered in this passage, is with, alongside, near, in association with, it speaks of an interactive relationship. It also means in spite of, which I take to mean that God will complete his mission in spite of Moshe's feelings, or yours, or mine. It's something I have long known, but it is nice to see it in writing, nevertheless. Yahweh prefers to do things, even the big things, with us, through us, rather than alone. Sure, if I said he could have blasted the Egyptians and then paved a yellow brick road for his people to follow home. But instead, he went with Moshe. Instead, he revealed his Torah along the way. Instead, he provided us with a target audience where, as a control group, we are now privy to what Israel did right and wrong, what caused enormous benefit, and what the consequences were when they were wayward and astray. Also, God could have written his word on an enormous tablet, and he could have held it up in the sky, or he could have developed a Moloch spiritual implement to scribe a word doc on a universal hard drive, putting it on the internet for all to see. Well, that might have been a little tough back there 3,400 years ago, but you get the idea. It just isn't his style. In spite of us, he seems to enjoy our company. He likes working with us. You know, I toiled lovingly at the keyboard from before sunrise to well after sunset, 6 and 7 days a week. And yet, you know, I could just fill out my hard drive on the computer and all 35 books could have appeared at once. They could have been perfectly correct. The vocabulary could have been spectacular. The alliterations enchanting. The insights illuminating. It could have been perfect. But that's not how God wants it to be. He likes teaching us. He enjoys watching us learn. It is what we're going to be doing together for all eternity. He knows there's a sense of satisfaction when you have earned a conclusion or an insight because you've made the proper connections. You've come to understand how things fit together. And then you can draw these unheralded insights and have the great joy of sharing them for the first time. Moreover, God wants his people to know that everything I have to share has been available to them for well over 3,000 years. They have no excuse They could have read what I've read, come to understand it, and enjoyed a far different fate than what they have endured up to this point. Working together is why we exist. God continued, and this is your sign, that indeed I myself have sent you. When you come out with the people from the crucibles of Egyptian oppression, you will work with God upon this specific mountain. Think of the miracle of this. The most powerful nation on earth with the largest and most successful military. Tutmosis was perhaps the single most militaristic and successful conqueror among Egyptian pharaohs. The only one who could have rivaled him would have been Ramses the Great. They were a superpower in their day. And yet Yahweh just stated that the slaves who had no weapons, who had nothing going for them, no education, no means of mobility, that they would get out of the mud and rise above the pharaohs and their military and walk out of that place and then come to this one, making the same journey that Moshe had earlier in his life. It's also interesting that Yahweh likes things that come full circle. He introduced himself to Moshe and to us on Mount Chorah. And he would bring us back to Mount Chorah to teach us his Torah. And it is the lessons of Mount Chorah through the Torah that God will integrate into our very existence, writing them into the fabric of our lives when the covenant is renewed upon his return in year 6,000 Yah, just 9 years from this day. Well, that is precisely what happened. Moshe, with a considerable assist from God, led his people out of Egypt, directly across the Red Sea and into Arabia, back to Mount Chorah. Can you imagine, though, if today's progressive media had been on the job and the criticisms they would have lobbed at the children of Israel? They would have presented the Egyptians as loving and kind and innocent civilians as opposed to slavers who worked these people virtually to death and who had already begun genocide and seeking to annihilate them. And yet they would have presented the Egyptians as innocent civilians and tallied their body counts. And they would have presented the Jews as belligerents, as the ones perpetrating genocide as opposed to fleeing for their very lives. But we're getting ahead of our story. Having returned to this place, Moshe continued to work with Yahweh. Together, they would reveal the Torah, which means teaching and guidance. The affirmation that God was going to accompany Moshe on this mission was evidently good enough for the reluctant liberator, as it should have been for us. Therefore, there was only one thing left that had to be resolved. The Egyptians, the Canaanites, Hittites, Phoenicians, Minoans, Carthaginians, Babylonians, and Assyrians. Well, they had a plethora of gods, all of which had names, and all of which had been credited for all manner of human endeavors. Moshe knew the first question that he would be asked. So, and Moshe said to God, look, if I go to the children of Israel, and I say to them, the God of their fathers sent me out to you, and they ask, so, what is his personal and proper name? Shim Hu. What shall I say to them? Right, left, that Moshe. It's the most important mission a man or woman can undertake, reaching out to the children of Israel at God's behest. It is the most important question a man or woman can ask. What should I tell them is God's personal and proper name. Of that, my friends, there is only one answer. Many may seek the will of God for their lives, and yet here it is for the accepted. Many declare that they want to know God, and yet here is an engraved invitation. While God would give Moshe a direct answer, he did not do so immediately. This is his approach to almost everything. His preference is to teach, to instruct, so that we go beyond knowing to understanding. Understanding is infinitely more empowering than it's simply knowing. Not willing to invest the time to go the next step, we humans have come to know many things, but understanding remains elusive. And without the proper perspective, without making the appropriate connections, without a discriminating filter, too much information can be distracting and disorienting, even misleading. This is the undercurrent supporting, well, every religion, every political party, patriotism, militarism, and conspiracy. Knowing tidbits of truth and not being able to connect them such that there is understanding. Yes, God wants us to know his name, but there's far more to his name that he wants us to understand. He wants us to comprehend his name, to understand his name. There was a bigger difference between Amun-Ra, Amun, Aten, Horus, Seb, Isis, Osiris, Sobek, et al., and Yahweh, from the pronunciation of some letters. Yahweh is for real. He exists. He created man, and man created each of these imposters. By revealing the basis of his name, Yahweh explained its meaning, as well as how to pronounce it. So God said to Moshe, I am Hayah. I was, I exist, and I always will be, showing the way to the benefits of the relationship, because I am. Ihaya Asher, Ihaya. I am showing the way to the benefits of the relationship because I am. I exist. Yahweh is based upon the vowels which comprise Haya. Haya was used twice in this brief statement. I am who I am. Haya. Asher. Haya. And Haya, whether it is read from right to left or left to right, is one of the most common verbs in the Hebrew language. No question as to how it's pronounced. There's no question as to what it means. And since Hebrew exists such that there is no verb stuck in time, but all verbs are liberated in time, Haya means I was, I am, and I will be. Simply, I exist. It provides us with all but one of the four letters in Yahweh's name in terms of the pronunciation of it, replicating the presentation of the two hays and the yod. They're there in Haya. Hey, yod, hey. Haya. Therefore, we know that Yahweh's name begins with Yah and ends with Ah. Only one thing is left, and that's how do we pronounce the Wah? The only addition as I have mentioned, is this one letter a law? One of the most common in its appearance throughout the Torah. It is used, however, in the heart of the very book that provides us with this introduction to God. You no doubt know that the Torah was the book that Yahweh revealed to Moshe. But do you know how Torah is spelled? Do you know that Torah derives the O sound from the wa? It is written with a wa in the midst of it. Even has the hey at the end. So it's Torah. Well, that would tell you that the wa in Yahweh's name is pronounced similar. And if you were to question that, then what is the single most repeated word by Hebrews speaking people worldwide? In fact, Jews that even don't speak Hebrew will say this, Shalom. Where do you think the O sound comes from in Shalom? It is from the wall. Again, reinforcing the proper way to pronounce Yahweh's name. Hayah can be translated has been, was, am, will be, and become, to exist, to occur, to happen, and to transpire, to take place, come about, and abide. Hayah appears over 3,500 times in the Hebrew text of the Torah and Prophets, almost always in the call stem, denoting a genuine relationship, which should not be interpreted subjectively, but instead objectively, literally, genuinely, actually. The Asher that appeared between the two Hayas is one of the most intriguing words in the Hebrew lexicon. It can be translated as simply who, which, with, where, when, or that, but it is best understood when rendered in God's declarative statement. My preference is to translate Asher as to show the steps along the way which lead to the benefits of the relationship. It serves as a guide to show us the correct, albeit narrow and restrictive path to get the most out of life. As is the case with the law, Asher exists to establish a relationship between things, to make a comparison. It conveys a relevant and relative reference, resulting in a better understanding of Yahweh's message. Asher can serve as a particle, as a conjunction, as a noun, as a proper name, and as a verb. Asher is devoted to the relationship. It is for our benefit. Asher exists to show us the way. Asher serves as a blessing. Yahweh's answer conveys all of the following. I exist, I was, I am, and I always will be. I am God. I am responsible for your existence. I am the source of your continued existence. I am exactly who I say I am. Therefore, by using these words, Hayah, Asher, Hayah, Yahweh told us he actually exists, that our continued existence is predicated upon him, that relationships are of vital interest to him. And he told us how to pronounce his name. Yahweh is derived from this verb, Hayah. Yahweh's name is actionable. And then he said, tell this to the children of Yisrael. I am, Ihayah, has sent me to you. Shemoth names. Exodus 3:14. There clearly is no higher authority or greater calling. The source of our existence, the only God who actually exists, would travel from Mount Chorab in Arabia to the Nile Delta and then back again with an 80-year-old stuttering shepherd to rescue his wayward children from the most oppressive religious, political, and military power man had yet conceived. Well, this, of course, would be interesting. It has been said so many times that we can be certain Yahweh wants everyone to know that he was on a mission to liberate his people, the children of Israel, from institutionalized religious and political persecution. God was not saving Orthodox Jews, faithful Christians, or deadbeat Muslims. He was not trying to rescue them for the sake of a religion, but it would instead mock religion while shattering its controlling consequences. Rather than blessing nations, he would destroy one, and then many more in the process. God was not issuing commands, delineating a set of laws, or asking anyone to obey him. He was instead freeing Israel from bondage. That is a stunning blow to Orthodox Jews, Christians, and Muslims. They have all sought to oppress Yehudim, either with their debilitating laws, ruthless persecution, or genocidal rage, when each institution stand is in direct opposition to Yahweh. Those who promote the myth that God's name isn't known, that it isn't important, that it cannot and should not be pronounced, stop reading at this point. But God was not finished speaking. Moreover, Shemoth names 13:13, or 3:13, I should say, and 3:14, are Yahweh's marvelous ways of telling us exactly how to spell and how to speak his name, even understand his name. This was not a random diatribe. Ehiyah, Asher Ehiyah reveals the basis of Yahweh's name, the meaning of Yahweh's name, even the proper pronunciation of Yahweh's name. He has already left everyone who would say otherwise without excuse. And yet he was not done talking. It is with profound animosity that I bring you this next statement. My frustration is not with God, but with his creation. It matters not if you read the KJV, NKJV, IV, NIV, ASV, NASV, ESV, or JPS. The error is universal among them. Yahweh answered Moshe's question directly, providing the prophet and liberator with his personal and proper name, not once, but twice. And he even said that Yahweh will be my name forever, my memorial for all generations. And yet, almost every scholar and theologian responsible for crafting a translation eliminated God's name and replaced it with Satan's ambition and title, Lord. The single and solitary name capable of saving us from mankind's religious and political schemes was removed by the people responsible for promoting these plagues. And furthermore, Wa'od, again and again repeating himself beyond what would be expected to bear witness, God, Elohim, declared Amar to Moshe, one who draws out. You should say, Amar, this ko, to El, the children of Yisrael, Bene Yisrael, the descendants who want to engage and endure with God. Yahweh, God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Yishak, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my personal and proper name, Shemani, forever. This is the way I want to be remembered throughout every generation and dwelling place. Well, that is why we turn to this text. The only way to argue with this is to argue with God. These are his words. They are memorialized in his Torah guidance. Yahweh is God's name. Yahweh has been and always will be God's one and only name. It does matter who you are. It doesn't matter what language you speak or where you live. God does care what you call him. If you know God, you refer to him as Yahweh. If you don't, you don't know him, and he does not know you. If you are not using God's name, he is not listening to you. He does not know you. He has no interest in you. Your worship, praise, and prayers are a waste of time and energy. You can bob your head against that goddamn wall until you're black and blue. And God's going to pay no attention. Yahweh is the one who established the covenant, doing so with Abraham, then Yishak, and Jacob. Yahweh is our liberator and savior. Yahweh is the name Moshe used to deliver the children of Israel. God has no other name. The covenant has no other sponsor. There is no other redeemer. Well, that and his beloved son died, because once again, when it came to our redemption, God chose to work through his beloved and not alone. The Lord is a title. It's the name of another spirit. The Lord is not God. The Lord cannot save. There is no inheritance right associated with man's religious deities. If I told you that my name is Yada, and that Yada means that I always wanted to know and to be known, and you ignored my request and called me master instead, I would know several things about you. First, you don't know me. Second, you do not love me. Third, you are intent on irritating me. The same is true of Yahweh. He told us that his name is Yahweh. If you call him Lord, all you're doing is irritating him. These same lessons apply. For those who have fallen victim to the religious lie that God's name is too sacred to be spoken and or no one really knows how to pronounce it, here is some news for you. God just told Moshe to say it. God just told Moshe to say it. So how can your rabbi be right if he tells you not to say it? The four Hebrew letters which comprise Yahweh's name are not unique. They are ubiquitous throughout the Torah. And yet no one claims that the Hebrew language is unpronounceable. The fact is there are 5 vowels and 17 consonants in ancient Hebrew, the language of Revelation. Aleph and Ein are vowels, along with the Yod, the He, and the Waw, the last 3 of which appear in Yahweh's name. We know from countless other Hebrew words that a yod is pronounced similar to the letter Y in the English word yes. A hey is pronounced ah, as in haya, the very basis of Yahweh's name. And we know from Torah and shalom that the Y conveys the O sound in Hebrew. Therefore, God's name is Yahweh. He has provided us with the proper vocalization. We are without excuse. Well, I thank you for listening to this, the third and final episode of Let's Know and Use Yahweh's Name. It is the single most important initial step in being reacquainted with our Creator and enjoying the benefits that He is offering through His Bereh and through His Mikreh. May Yah bless you all. Shalom in Yahweh's name. This has been the Yahweh Blog, and I am your host, Craig Wynn.